women are still a far cry from equal when it comes to representation in state politics. We're talking about what the numbers say and how women lawmakers operate in the halls of government. It's The Morning Show. Good morning, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There are 132 lawmakers here in Wisconsin. 27% of them are female. Are you a woman in government? What impact do you think representation in leadership can have? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234. Molly Beck is a state government and politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's been looking at the number of women in government and what that tells us. Molly, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me back.
So you and your colleague compiled the numbers. You interviewed women on the ground in the halls of Wisconsin politics. What were you trying to tease out here? How did this project come together?
So about 100 years ago, almost to the month, Wisconsin became the first state in the country to ratify the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. And the Journal Sentinel is running a series of stories this year to recognize that. And one story that my colleague Mary Spacuzza and I wanted to look at as political reporters is the level of female representation in the state legislature and in Congress. You know, people who are elected from Wisconsin who are women. And that number has not, you know, there's more than 50% of the population in Wisconsin are women, but the representation number has never gotten above, I believe, you know, 28%.
Yeah, so let's look a little bit closer at that gender breakdown in Wisconsin politics. How has the growth of women in politics been slow? Has it been slow? Has it been kind of static?
Yeah, it hasn't changed very much. The numbers haven't really changed very much over the last couple decades. I think the highest number of women in the state legislature was 37, and right now we're at 36. So we're about at the record number right now. But, you know, that those numbers have not really changed much over the last few years. And I think that's mostly due to there are pretty few Republican women in the legislature. We see more women on the Democratic side run.
Right. And you interviewed former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish, one of the state's most high profile Republican women. What did she have to say about her experience?
Yeah, her story is pretty interesting. She was not, you know, the Republican Party's pick that year. She ran in 2010 in a primary against several male candidates, including the candidate that the party was getting behind. And she won that primary and obviously became lieutenant governor when Governor Scott Walker won. And she said that she got a lot of criticism from people in politics who said, you know, you really need to start out at a much, you know, less prominent role. You know, you should probably seek a seat on the school board or on, you know, the village board before you try to run statewide. And she also said that she, you know, when she was knocking on doors and trying to get voter support, some people said, you know, you really should be staying at home with your kids, because at that point she had two young daughters.
You also spoke with Sheila Stubbs, a Democrat in the Assembly who represents parts of Madison. What did she have to say about women's representation in state government?
So Representative Stubbs is one of, I believe, just six African-American lawmakers in the state legislature. And I wanted to talk to her just as her, you know, to talk about her experience as a lawmaker of color. And what she said is that she's there because, you know, when you go to the Capitol, it's, you know, there are no photos on the wall or paintings on the wall of anybody of color. And that's what she wants to do. She wants to start, you know, making historical, you know, moments basically for the Capitol to recognize at some point.
We're looking at the historical context and the current reality for women holding elected office here in Wisconsin. Molly Beck has been taking a closer look at the numbers and the trends over the years, over the decades. She's a state government and politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in 800-642-1234. Are you a woman who holds an elected office? What was that like running for that seat? Why did you do it? And what impact do you think representation in leadership can have? Call in. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Molly, take us way, way back, Wisconsin being the first state to ratify the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote, as you said earlier. What was that process like? How did we become the first state to give women suffrage?
So we were the first state because actually Illinois was supposed to be the first state to ratify it, and it turns out that we got to it first. And soon after that, in 1919, there were, you know, a few suffrage campaign leaders that ran for U.S. Senate and seats in the state assembly, and one woman ran for a seat in the state Senate, and none of them won. The woman that ran for U.S. Senate, Jesse Jack Hooper, she ran in 1922 for the U.S. Senate, and she ran against Robert La Follette. So she did not win that race.
Right, that would have been a hard one. Theodora Yeomans was also a major player in this movement.
Yeah, that's right. And what we're trying to look at in these series of stories is, you know, why that happened in Wisconsin, and you know, whether it really broke open a dam, so to speak, you know, of women in politics. And it looks like it, you know, we've come a long way, but that we still have a long way to go too.
You also focus on Vel Phillips, who was a civil rights leader in Milwaukee, had many firsts attached to her accomplishments in elected office. And she once said, when people would say, what's hardest, being the first woman or the first Black? And she said, when I really think about it, very often, there were times when they do forget that I'm a Black person, but they never forget that I'm a woman. Tell us about her legacy.
Yeah. She also has an interesting story, obviously. When she first ran statewide for Secretary of State and for City Council in Milwaukee, she did not, you know, her campaign literature didn't have any pictures of her. And that was because she wanted to hide her gender and also her race. And so, because her name Vel is, you know, that's not automatically going to trigger, you know, somebody thinking that's a woman. So, that was, you know, kind of her campaign strategy, and it worked, obviously.
And she was so persistent in elected office. Every time something was voted down in terms of housing rights, she would just come back and come back. She wouldn't take no for an answer.
Right. And the women on the Milwaukee City Council now, they really credit her for paving a way for, you know, women not being afraid to A, run, and B, you know, not be content to just sit and be quiet.
Wisconsin is at a near record high for women serving in an elected office, and they still hold barely a quarter of seats. We're talking about women in office with Molly Beck as our guide. She's state government and politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Gathering your thoughts along the way, your stories on running for office, 800-642-1234. Perhaps you serve on a school board or a city council seat. Do you think it's important to achieve gender parity in politics? You can call in, email your thoughts to ideas@wpr.org. We'll get back to this in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about female representation in Wisconsin elected offices. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Governor Tony Evers suggested earlier this week that top Republicans would not meet with his top aides because of sexism. He said in a statement that, quote, only Robin Voss and Scott Fitzgerald can say why they won't work with the women who are leading my office, unquote. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald refuted that claim. It's one of the facets of this conversation as we look at how female lawmakers work inside the Capitol. Gathering your thoughts on women in elected office along the way, 800-642-1234. Are you a woman in government? Do you think about gender at the voting booth? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel politics reporter Molly Beck is our guide, and she's been writing about Wisconsin female lawmakers. Molly, another Wisconsin politician with some historic firsts on her record is, of course, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. She was the first woman elected to the U.S. Congress from Wisconsin in 1998 before becoming the first openly gay U.S. senator in 2012. Mm-hmm. Did any of the women you talked to mention the symbolism behind their positions?
It depends on who you talk to. I spoke recently with the first female lieutenant governor, Margaret Farrow, and she said, you know, I didn't do any of this. She was the first, you know, female on her village board and the first female village board president and then the first, you know, female lieutenant governor. She might have been the first female to hold the assembly seat she held, I believe. But she said that, you know, I didn't do any of this because I was a woman. I wasn't seeking that recognition. But she also acknowledged that, you know, because she was able to do that, that, you know, shows younger women, especially at that time, because I think her first position was in the 70s, that, you know, it's possible for women. Because sometimes you look at, when you look at the legislature, it's, you know, there's a lot of men there. So it might, some women might feel intimidated by that or just not see it as something that they belong in, you know. But you talk to others like Tammy Baldwin, who said that, you know, she was really inspired by other female you know, politicians and wanted to do the same for others and, you know, really kind of championed that role of being the first woman in certain roles.
How do the numbers of women in politics here in Wisconsin compare to other states across the country? How do we stack up?
So it depends on what, you know, body you're looking at. The overall, we are lagging behind the nation. We are about almost to the national average of about 29%, but we are consistently behind that overall. If you look at the Supreme Court, however, we are actually leading the nation in the percentage of female justices.
Right, that, six out of the seven justices.
Right.
Is that that's an anomaly? How did that happen?
So it's been great. I believe I wrote a story a few years ago when it was five out of the seven, mm-hmm. and that was still leading the nation. So Wisconsin has just had always been, I believe, you know, in the top 10, if not, you know, the top one, two, or three in female representation on the Supreme Court. And I think when you probably want to know, like, what is the difference between the legislature and the Supreme Court? And I think you have to look at the bench, and there are just more women becoming lawyers and in the judicial, you know, field generally than in the political world.
Let's take a call. Let's go to Mark joining us from Bloomer. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. I'm thinking about women in elected office, and I'm thinking about my mother, and I'm thinking about my wife. And I think we'd all be better off if there were less men in office and more women in office, because honestly, I think the women are smarter than us men as a whole.
Mark, did anyone in your family ever run for elected office?
They were too smart to run.
Well, curious, Mark, when you go to the voting booth, do you think about gender or not?
I look for the most qualified candidate. And I have been very impressed with the women who I've seen run for public office.
Mark, thanks so much for weighing in, for the call. Molly, you also talked to Justice Shirley Abrahamson, who is the first woman to sit on the state Supreme Court and is the longest serving justice in state history. What did she have to say about her historic tenure?
Well, we actually weren't able to interview her, but we did find a book that she had written a passage in about her time on the Supreme Court and just what that was like, mm-hmm. To be, you know, a woman at that time in the, you know, the law field. And she said that she was the only woman in her law school graduating class. And the only reason she went to Madison was because it was the only law firm that would give her a job as a lawyer when she graduated, which she graduated top in her class, if not the top, but in, you know, the top among the top students. She was offered jobs as a librarian, but not a lawyer. So the only reason she's even in Wisconsin, she's not from Wisconsin, is because mm-hmm. it was the only place that she could get a job. And she, you know, also wrote that, you know, she's happy to have blazed that trail for other women. And that could be, you know, she didn't say this, but that could be why there's always been a lot of women on the court, because, you know, she's been on the court since the 70s.
When you talked to these women in elected office, did you ask them at all about that journey on the campaign trail that can be grueling, that can get really dirty in terms of the mudslinging? What did they say about that?
Yeah, I think the only thing that when you talk to female candidates, the only thing that's different than if you talk to male candidates is there is an element that they feel that some voters just don't believe they should be, if they have children specifically, that they should be out campaigning. They should be, you know, at home with their kids. And that's just not something male candidates hear as often.
And we saw over the past weekend there was this back and forth between Governor Evers' administration and Republican leaders in the legislature about the ability to work with women. Help us understand what happened there in that exchange.
Yeah, so over the weekend, the state Republicans held their annual convention in Oshkosh. And at the convention, the Senate Majority Leader, Scott Fitzgerald, was talking about the Republicans in the legislature, their relationship with Democratic Governor Tony Evers, and how there essentially isn't one right now. He said that he doesn't know who the point person is in Governor Evers' office to talk to about budget matters and other things. And that, you know, the governor's office responded and said, you know, we've said over and over that it's our chief of staff, Maggie Gao. That's who the Republican lawmakers should be talking to. So, you know, this was not something that was confusing when they were dealing with Governor Scott Walker, they said, because his chief of staff was male. And so there was some back and forth on that. You know, the governor's office is saying that, you know, the Republicans are complaining about they don't know who to work with because it's women and they don't want to work with women. The Republican lawmakers are saying that's ridiculous. We have lots of women in our offices. You know, why won't the governor work with us? So it's still ongoing.
Yeah. How could this be then connected to the disagreements in the Capitol over the state budget?
So the Republican lawmakers say that they want to negotiate over the state budget with Governor Evers, because right now the proposed state budget from Governor Evers is much different than what the Republican lawmakers are currently crafting and have said that they would pass. They're not going to resemble each other at all at this point.
Wide gap.
So, mm-hmm. Right. And so the Republican lawmakers are saying that they want to sit down with Governor Evers to negotiate. And, you know, Governor Evers' position is, well, you won't negotiate with my chief of staff when you've done that before with other governors. So what's the difference?
And Republican leaders Robin Voss and Scott Fitzgerald told WisPolitics that they're considering splitting the budget into two separate bills. Mm-hmm. What do we know there?
Yeah, so that would give one of the bills would have only appropriations, so only the amount of money that the state would be spending on different programs. And the second bill would be just pure policy programs, no appropriations listed. And that would be done to avoid giving Governor Evers the ability to use his line item veto. on at least one of the documents, but it also gives Governor Evers the opportunity to just veto the bill that has no money attached to it. So we'll see if that happens.
Is there precedent there?
You know, I believe they've done that before with different areas of the budget, like transportation or, you know, things like that. I'm not sure that they've done it, you know, with the whole budget. I haven't seen that before.
Molly, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Molly Beck is a state government and politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's been writing about how Wisconsin lags the national average in electing women to office. Coming up, WPR's High Tolerance Alcohol series continues with a look at the impact on children in foster care. That's after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In La Crosse County, about 80% of the cases Child Protective Services works on involve alcohol and drug use. And as part of our ongoing series called High Tolerance, Hope Kerwin reports on the toll adults drinking can take on our state's children.
Mike Desmond is the former director of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater La Crosse. That's how he met the child he and his wife Karen would eventually foster, a 14-year-old boy who we're calling Kay. Desmond says Kay and his brothers were living in a hotel with their mom, and it was clear there were problems. So one day, Desmond gave Kay his phone number.
And they called me shortly after that, and I went down to the hotel and picked up 5 of the 6 boys.
Desmond says the boys started living with them informally until they could get placements through the foster care system. And he felt like Kay and his brothers were finally getting the care that they longed for.
They love their mom, and their mom loves them. I just think with the alcohol, she wasn't always capable of giving them the attention and love that they needed.
Lila Barlow from La Crosse County's foster care program says Kay's situation is common. She says a parent's drinking often comes with use of other drugs, and many times they're using substances to cope with stress, trauma, or another mental health issue.
When you start putting that combination together, then we're looking at more of 90% of our cases have a mental health or a drug and alcohol combination of some sort, and to try to weed that out is really, really difficult.
Barlow says the number of substance-related cases has increased in recent years because of the rise in opioid use. But she says alcoholism has always been a problem, and it often goes undetected.
In a state like Wisconsin, where alcohol is a norm, it's socially accepted. I think it's very hard for the friends, the neighbors, the families to say someone has an alcohol issue.
Barlow says when friends or family members see a parent's alcohol use as normal, they justify when that parent gets too drunk to care for their children in a way they wouldn't if the parent was using drugs. But Tony Aniga says any kind of substance abuse by parents can have a huge impact on a child's future. He's an education specialist at Marshfield Clinic's Child Advocacy Center.
It really affects healthy brain development, which can lead to toxic stress or that toxic stress adaptation, where children then become very good at perceiving threat and fear, and they don't become very good at learning and viewing teachers and other adults as safe.
Aniga says when kids' brains are wired for surviving stress at home, they have a hard time focusing in class or even remembering basic instruction. But those kids are learning from their parents. Aniga says kids pick up on the ways their parents are using alcohol to cope with stress.
If the parent is reactive, if the parent is aggressive, if the parent is, you know, punching holes in the wall, that's what that child is learning.
Aniga says these kids need to have relationships with adults who don't depend on alcohol to understand there's a different way. People like Mike Desmond. Desmond says he tried to help Kay see what life is like without depending on alcohol. But he says Kay was already drinking when he first came to stay with him at the age of 14. And Desmond knows there's a good chance Kay could fall into alcoholism the same way his mom did.
Traumatized kids use. And they use for the same reason adults use. You're not happy with your life. You think your life's going nowhere. You have no self-esteem. And guess what? Alcohol deadens that pain.
But Iniguez argues it's not just kids in crisis who can learn unhealthy ways of coping from adults through alcohol.
When you have adults, parents, teachers, you know, people that even joke about having that glass of wine or that beer, you know, after work, after having a stressful day, kids start to make those associations that, you know, oh, that's the thing that basically helps me deal with stress.
Iniguez says all adults, not just parents, need to be careful we're not passing down an unhealthy relationship with alcohol to the next generation. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And you can read more about this story and see the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. We're talking about recovery coaches in Dane County who help pregnant women in the grips of addiction. Dozens of states have policies on the books to try to stop pregnant women from drinking and taking drugs. And research out this month in the journal PLOS One finds that these policies are not helping babies due to a mother's fear of prosecution and fear of seeking prenatal care. We're learning about a program that connects women who are pregnant and have substance use disorders with a recovery coach. What questions do you have about how drug or alcohol use impacts pregnancy? Are you a mother who struggled with substance use during a pregnancy? What was that like? We're at 800-642-1234. Tanya Craigie is here. She's a recovery coach supervisor at Safe Communities of Madison, Dane County, and it founded the Pregnancy to Recovery Program in August of 2017, along with SSM Health. Tanya, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, let's start with a bit of background. What got Safe Communities thinking about a program like this? What kind of need was out there?
So actually, the need came from a needs assessment that was done throughout Wisconsin, really reaching out and asking pregnant women what were the biggest barriers in Wisconsin to them receiving help and then staying connected after that. And out of that needs assessment, what came from that was the number one barrier for them was stigma, feeling like they were being judged by their providers, and then not having the education or the resources to be able to get treatment and to get help. They also identified that having someone who had been through a similar experience as they're going through right now alongside them would have been really helpful to them. So we took this information and we kind of joined up this idea of recovery coaches and specially trained the coaches that we work with to work specifically with pregnant women, as well as they all have the lived experience of having had substance use disorder, had experienced that shame, that guilt, that embarrassment, and now they have long-term recovery and they have really good relationships with their children. And so now they can share, you know, their journeys with them, as well as like this hope for recovery.
So what are we seeing in terms of the numbers? Are we seeing more expectant mothers dealing with issues of substance use?
So from 2004 to 2014, there was a fivefold increase of babies that were experiencing neonatal abstinence syndrome. And so there's definitely been an increase of women using opioids during pregnancy, which opioids is kind of its own beast in a way, because women can't just stop using opioids while they're pregnant. It's really harmful to the fetus. It could jeopardize the mother, and then also being up and down on substances and not being stable can really, really mess with the birth and the development of the baby, and they could lose the child if they just were to cease using during pregnancy. So it's kind of its own thing, which was originally why we created the program, was to work with women who are pregnant using opioids. And then we've expanded now to working with all women with all substance use disorders.
We're talking about a Dane County pilot program that helps expectant mothers through substance addiction. Tanya Craigie is here. She's recovery coach supervisor at Safe Communities of Madison, Dane County. You can join in 800-642-1234. Are you a mother who struggled with substance use during a pregnancy? And if so, what helped you through that time? What questions do you have about the pregnancy to recovery program? Call in. You can also tweet us at WP. Mornings. So, Tanya, tell us about the Pregnancy to Recovery program. When did it launch? Who's eligible? How does it work?
So, we began the program in August of 2017. Our partners were and still are SSM Healthcare, so like Dean, St. Mary's. We initially reached out to the high-risk pregnancy clinic, and now we've expanded to working with public health, working with UW and Meritor, and really taking referrals from anyone, even a woman that's struggling herself, can call our pregnancy hotline and request a recovery coach, and we can try to link the woman up with somebody that matches their experience as closely as we can. And that program has now expanded even beyond our initial help, which was working with women up to 3 months postpartum. And it was only women and it was only opioids. Now we do all substances. Now we do up to a year postpartum because we were really seeing women struggle, you know, 3 weeks to a month.
3 months is so short.
Right, right.
I mean,
and the postpartum period. And so they would do really well during maybe their pregnancy and a few weeks afterwards. And then they would really be struggling, and we're like, this isn't enough. And now we added a father component too. So we have a father coach that can work with the expectant fathers of the baby that's coming and really help try to get that family unit to work well with one another and be healthy.
And earlier we heard a piece from Hope Kerwin about alcohol in the foster care system. And some might look at alcohol and opioids interchangeably, but where do you see the similarities and the differences in terms of treatment?
Well, unfortunately, I think that we lack treatment all over the state and adequate treatment and access to health care and access to that treatment through that health care. Unfortunately, a lot of the women that we work with are on state assistance, and a lot of times the state assistance doesn't allow for individuals to attend certain treatments. So if they need like a higher level of care, it's difficult to get them into that higher level of care. So that's where the recovery coach comes in, is kind of supporting them in addition to maybe some outpatient treatment or some other things that they have going on for them, and helping advocate that they get, you know, preferred treatment and get in within that 48 hours that they can get for medication if they need it, for medication for opioid use disorder, or to get into inpatient treatment.
We're talking about the Pregnancy to Recovery program in Dane County that pairs recovery coaches with expectant moms and keeps up that support months postpartum. Tanya Craigie is recovery coach supervisor at Safe Communities of Madison, Dane County. You can join in 800-642-1234. Did you struggle with substance use during pregnancy? What helped you through that time? What would have helped you if you could have accessed it? And how are you doing today? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Pregnancy to Recovery program in Dane County. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The number of pregnant women with substance use disorders at labor and delivery more than quadrupled from 1999 to 2014. That's according to the latest data published last year by the CDC. And one facet of the Dane County program is a support group for women who've had a baby while using drugs and women who are currently pregnant and struggling with substance use disorders. Your questions, your journey through this, all welcome. 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how drug or alcohol use impacts pregnancy? You can call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Tanya Craigie is our guide. She is recovery coach supervisor at Safe Counties of Madison, Dane County. Tanya, the pregnancy to recovery program that you have is pairing these recovery coaches who have been through addiction in pregnancy, and you're one of them. What was that like?
It was a long time ago that my brother had taken his life in 2004, and I didn't react well to that at all. I really proceeded to drink a lot and started using heavy drugs to numb the pain and not feel this major loss in my life. And throughout that, during that time, I became pregnant. And then I had a period of not using during that pregnancy. And then in about my ninth month, I had a doctor that was like, oh, you can have a glass of wine. It helps kind of in the later, you know, stages, relax you a little bit more. And I didn't know that, like, I had this issue, right? I had no idea that I had a substance use disorder. I didn't know that I couldn't just stop using on my own without, like, help, care, support, resources. And so when I took that wine, I figured that I would just have one glass. Well, then I kind of opened up Pandora's box, if you will, and had a couple more glasses. And then I relapsed on my drug of choice at the time, which was cocaine. And I felt so guilty afterwards that I went straight to my doctor and I was like, this is what happened. And he was amazing. He was so good to me. He didn't make me feel guilty or judged. He Dr. Rudat, rest in peace, he's no longer with us, but he really helped me get linked to treatment and to find extra resources. And I think that made all the difference at that time, because I really didn't have an idea. I grew up in a family that drank and used a lot of drugs. They still do. And to me, that was like normal. And so I never really saw that I had this issue, or that this was like a bad way or inappropriate way of coping with life when things happened. So it took me going to treatment and being around others to really be exposed to the idea that this wasn't something that I caused. It wasn't something that I set out to do in my life, to be addicted to drugs, but that there was help and there was hope out there.
What was it like after the baby?
Oh, it was a struggle. That first year of having her, I would have these periods where, she was in the NICU. So like right after I had her, she was in the NICU for 5 days from jaundice. And so she got really bad jaundice, and I didn't have any skills at that time to like deal with really big emotions. And so I would like go up to the NICU and I'd see my little baby in this machine, in this container, and I couldn't touch her and I couldn't be with her. And I would like freak out and I'd go to the bar and I'd have a couple drinks and then come back and just sit there. And then I'd like freak out again because I couldn't touch her. And so it was like this roller coaster. And all the time I'm like in treatment and I'm sharing this stuff with them. And so I'd have like a month and then I wouldn't use any substances. And then I would feel really good. And then I'd like celebrate that feeling good by like going out and having some drinks. And so that first year was really, really difficult. I had some consequences during that time. CPS did get involved, and then I took some time and went to treatment and then ended up going into sober living. And my daughter was living with my parents for a little while. So,
and today?
Today she's with me full time, and she has been since that time that I took off. I really wanted to focus on myself and get well, so that when I got her back, that, you know, I wouldn't lose her again.
And that's a story I'm sure you tell other expectant mothers as they go through that process. What about the stigma? And is there a fear of going to the OB and saying, look, I have this issue. I need help, but I'm fearful that my baby might be taken away from me. Is that real?
That is probably the biggest barrier. It's, you know, the most stigmatized word in the world, according to the World Health Organization, is addiction. And so when you look at the barriers that women or anybody faces with a substance use disorder, that is stigma. So we've worked very closely with SSM Healthcare because they asked us, like, we think that our providers, our nurses, our staff could use some anti-stigma training. So we did go in and we talked to them about seeing this woman not as what shows up in her epic, but really looking at that background story, like what brought this woman to where she is today, and how to work with her and alongside her on her issue rather than pushing her out more and isolating her so that she doesn't reach out ever. But first, you got to get to that precipice where you're even walking through that doctor's office to get that help. And
getting that prenatal care.
Yeah. And there is a law in Wisconsin, the cocaine mom law, that really puts a lot of fear in women's life so that they sometimes don't even go to the doctors and get any prenatal care at all because they're worried that they're going to get locked up if they admit that they're using substances while pregnant.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to John joining us from Boaz. Hi, John.
Hi. I have some good news, and there is hope. My mother was taken away and put into an orphanage because of her mother's drinking and her mother's way of life. She grew up in an orphanage. Pardon me. And because she was pretty and a nice person, she was in the right place at the right time and found a good man who's my father.
And so it sounds like, though, that, you know, your mother had issues, though, with substance abuse. And so and that had consequences.
Well, her mother did.
Her mother. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. My mother would shy away from any alcohol because she didn't want to go back into the orphanage institution. Yeah.
John, thank you so much for calling. And Tanya, what kind of support are there for these coaches who are trying to bring along these expectant mothers and connect them to the resources and what they need? Because that's a big emotional burden there.
It is. And I'd like to say that we have a very close-knit, somewhat family-like environment at Safe Communities, where we provide a lot of support, a lot of supervision, a lot of self-care and promotion for that self-care. And so we check in often about what their self-care is looking like, what their own recoveries are looking like, maybe how they might need some more support themselves. That's really the bulk of the work that we do. We've created our own, you know, recovery community organization, and in turn, we're helping others find that.
What is the path forward for pregnancy to recovery? Because now that you have that footing being formed in 2017, where does it go from here?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Kate. Our funding actually ends at the end of August of this year, and that funding came from the CDC, and we have not been able to procure new funding yet for that, but we're hoping that the county will pick it up with some of the other recovery coaching programs that we have.
And if someone is out there listening and thinking that they may need the pregnancy to recovery program, that this would be the right fit for them, how do they get involved?
They can call us. Our phone number for that program is 608-228-1247.
And we'll have that information on our page as well at WPR.org on the morning show. Tanya, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Tanya Craigie is Recovery Coach Supervisor at Safe Communities of Madison, Dane County, and it founded the Pregnancy to Recovery Program along with SSM Health. And you can find, by the way, a link to the Pregnancy to Recovery Program at WPR.org on the Morning Show page. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.